This is On Deadline, where the biggest stories, the smartest journalists, and the conversations that matter come together from Odyssey news stations across the country. When news breaks, the story doesn't stop there. I'm Christy Strasser. Let's get started. Where have all the mosquitoes gone? Turns out they've dropped 50 to 70% in population in many parts of the country because of drought. Dry pools don't breed mounds of mosquitoes, but inside that silver lining is a dagger, because fewer mosquitoes fighting for less water means they're congregating, and that tight grouping means more West Nile virus. Here's Tommy Tucker in New Orleans.
We really start to notice the mosquitoes. Aaron Ashberg joins us, assistant professor of peri-urban entomology at LSU. Talk about bugs. Tell me what the deal is with mosquitoes this year so far.
Two different trends, what I would say with mosquitoes is when we're not experiencing this rain, we're still going to be encountering mosquitoes. But what is interesting about them is actually when the temperatures are warmer out, mosquitoes grow faster. But there's a trade-off with that. They end up actually being a little bit smaller in size. And so that actually reduces their ability to kind of get around well, but also their disease risk.
I love talking to you because I learn something new every time I do.
And because of their smaller size, there's actually been some science to show that they're less capable of transmitting disease, which is good for us in some cases.
So it's a good thing that the temperatures are warmer. That's what the takeaway is?
In some ways, yes. We're going to receive some less mosquito pressure just because we're not encountering those rains. But when we do have rain, of course, we're going to have that big flush of mosquitoes that we're pretty commonly encountering afterwards.
You know, what I should do is bring the audience in here. Tell me, on a scale of 1 to 10, 1 being not too bad at all, 10 being horrific, where are you on the mosquito scale where you live? Oh, I can't remember last time I was bitten by a mosquito.
Yeah, I agree. You know, I've been getting hit when I've been out here and there, but the pressure has been lower than what I encountered earlier in the summer. I tell you, I had to invest in a lot of sprays and repellents because I was getting mauled when I'd go outside.
Somebody wants to know if mosquitoes favor one person over the other. They say they swear that they can go out with other people and the mosquitoes are drawn to them. They are a mosquito magnet.
Yes. So there's been some work that has been shown that some people are more attractive to mosquitoes than others. It could be related to several factors. I know one of them was actually asthma and CO2 exhalation. So if somebody is exhaling more CO2 or more frequently, that might make them more attractive to mosquitoes. Now, some people have implicated blood type as being more attractive to mosquitoes, but they can't particularly detect that, at least from afar. So those are some of the reasons why you might see some different attraction with insects or mosquitoes. But, of course, they can kind of taste a little bit here and there. But now, with mosquitoes, I would also say people's odorants can be different, too. Mm-hmm. So that can make somebody more attractive to a mosquito beyond just exhalations or breath.
Mosquitoes of both genders bite you, or is it just one?
So actually, only female mosquitoes will bite. The males feed on pollen and nectar on plants. They don't, so they'll actually hang out around flowers in some cases, and so that's why we've got to be extra careful to make sure we don't treat those flowering areas when our pollinators are active. But of course, there are strategies that we can use to protect them while also managing mosquitoes.
There is no vaccine against West Nile virus, but there is controversy about a new executive order regarding MMR vaccines for children. Here's KCBS in the Bay Area.
UCSF infectious disease expert Peter Chin Hong, thank you so much for being with us this morning. What does this executive order concerning the measles, mump, and rubella vaccine dictate?
It dictates that instead of getting a combination shot of measles, mumps, and rubella all together in one jab, you should give it three separate shots. That is, instead of getting two shots at age 1 and age 5, for example, you'd be getting six shots at age 1, getting three, and three shots at age 5.
And why do medical experts and pediatricians object to this?
Well, there are several reasons why I think it's a bad idea. The first is that it's ironic because if you're trying to reduce the number of vaccines, you're actually increasing the number of shots for kids. The second is that it increases the number of visits that parents have to take time off work for, scheduling, paying co-pays. It may also mean that people may get, kids in particular, get more diseases because in between the time that you're waiting to get the next shot, that leaves you more susceptible to illness. And finally, one is logistic, which is that companies will then have to start separating the vaccines. It means that they'll have to demonstrate data for the efficacy of the separate vaccines and apply for regulatory approval.
So can children can't currently receive these three separate single shots?
Not typically, no. I think when you get a single separate shots, you're still combining MMR, and the one that's separate is the one for chickenpox. You can also get a combination MMR, measles, mumps, and rubella, and chickenpox or varicella together or separate. But the MMR always comes together as three.
Does this order change school vaccination rules?
No, it doesn't. So that's where things get confusing for people. There's actually no change in California because we have own laws regarding school vaccines. States have their own laws. Some states may pivot and change, but there's no evidence or sign that California is going to change anything because of this.
Now, there are other shots where there are more than one vaccine within the shot, like the DTaP. Was there any mention of any other shots like that?
No, there was no mention of other shots like DTaP. I think the reason for separating MMR is because of the flawed thinking that it may contribute to autism, but that has been debunked multiple times in the scientific literature.
How disruptive is it and confusing is it when you have a directive like this saying one thing, and the science community and pediatricians saying another?
It's extremely, extremely confusing. I think a lot of pediatricians and family doctors, family medicine doctors are spending time addressing the confusion with parents. It takes away from other parts of the healthcare visit. We're moving from an expert-led, coherent national lingua franca around what vaccines mean to one that's more based on politics and tribalism. And that's really bad, not just for politics, but for disease and public health. And it, again, it's coming in the face of increasing measles in the country, increasing whooping cough outbreaks. So all of this is setting back the clock.
What advice would you give for parents, especially parents of young children who want to get the best advice they can about the vaccines they need?
I think the best advice is that there's no change in California. There's no change in the science. There's no change in the safety. The only change is that we're trying to, again, increase the vaccination rate because that's been declining for flu and measles and whooping cough. So speak to your healthcare provider if you're confused, but you don't have to even say anything. You just do everything as regular, as normal. It's business as usual in California.
And one more question. What are the risks of some states having one set of rules and other states having another set of rules?
Well, it just means that they're more susceptible people and more susceptible children to childhood diseases that were vanquished before. And it's going to lead to more missed schools because every time a case of measles comes through and a child isn't fully immunized, it means that they have to stay away from school for 3 weeks for measles. So it's not like 5 days for COVID. And it may mean more cases of potential measles coming through, even in a state like California, from other states and disrupting, you know, public health with contact tracing and investigations. So that's one issue. And I think the other, outcome that we'll expect is a legal challenge. Again, this is probably all a workaround after the federal judge blocked the January schedule when they were trying to do this. And, you know, this is trying to have a workaround. But public health is very local. It's very state-driven right now.
Speaking of childhood dangers, more and more kids are getting injured by e-bikes this summer. Here's WWJ in Detroit.
Just the latest in a long line of e-bike crashes in Metro Detroit took place this past weekend in Redford. It happened around 9:30 on Saturday night in the area of Inkster and Clarita. A 13-year-old boy and a 15-year-old girl were riding an e-bike together and crossing the street when they were hit by a car. Now, the 13-year-old boy was left with a serious head injury and a broken arm, sending him to the ICU. The 15-year-old girl had several broken ribs. They are expected to be okay, though. The driver is cooperating with the investigation. Alcohol, drugs, or speed are not factors in this crash, but it joins a long list of ones involving teens and e-bikes this summer. These e-bikes can get up to 30 miles an hour, and police say that poor judgment from some of these teens can be blamed for the crashes. Parents of some of the kids involved say for other parents, they should simply just take their teens' e-bikes away completely.
E-bikes are a new way to get around and to hurt ourselves. But how far away are we from gadgets that can read our mind? Here's KCBS in the Bay Area.
Rapid advances in neurotechnology have uncovered the data connecting our thoughts. But the new possibilities are also introducing problems. To tell us more, Dr. Nita Farahani, professor at Duke Law School and the author of The Battle for Your Brain. Where are we now in being able to monitor a person's thoughts?
Well, I think if a person chooses to use a wearable neurotechnology today, we're a lot closer than we were even a few years ago. But as for remote monitoring of thoughts, we're still a long way to go from that.
Well, that's good. What's that's good, he says. What is an example of wearable neurotech?
So, you know, here the market is starting to explode. The probably simplest form of it that reads the least information is what Meta launched back in September of 2025. You can go to Best Buy if you have one of the Meta glasses. You need some way to be able to interact with it. And so they launched something called the Neural Band that picks up brain activity as it goes from your brain down your arm to your wrist and picks up your intention to swipe or type or move. That replaces the joystick or the keyboard that you might have used otherwise and uses neural signals. And I say that's the crudest because there are other technologies that you wear in your ears or behind your ear or on your head, and that's measuring the electrical activity in your brain more directly rather than your peripheral nervous system that travels to other parts of your body. And there are devices already on the market. They're just not the, you know, kind of Apple and Metas of the world who've launched them yet. But there's a lot of rumors that Apple is about to launch something similar, and they have entered into partnerships with some companies that make their neural products work with Apple products in a similar way.
Boy, I know what people are thinking. I'm okay with a smartwatch or a smart thing on my head that will tell me if I'm having a stroke or something like that. But I'm not okay with a device that can read what I'm thinking. Are we to that point where they can actually tell what we are thinking?
So I think, I mean, here is where it gets, you know, the kind of difference between the reality and the science fiction is worth noticing, which is what they're good at doing right now is measuring brain states. Like, are you tired? Are you paying attention or is your mind wandering? So they can be really useful in some settings like fatigue monitoring. People have driver assist technology that tells, you know, based on their steering wheel, whether they're falling asleep. This measures more directly brain activity. If you're thinking about thinking as like, I'm daydreaming and here are all of the thoughts I have about that daydream, there's really no consumer neurotechnology device that can decode that yet. What it can decode, though, is intentionally communicated speech. So if you have one of the better devices, it can take brain activity where you're thinking, like, I want to type out this message to my loved one, And then it can decode that intentional speech that you're trying to communicate. For a lot of people, that's a form of mind reading and thought. It's just the difference between thoughts that you're trying to communicate versus the kind of private thoughts that you're running over in your head. And technology hasn't reached those private thoughts you're running over in your head yet.
That is really something. So in the future, will I be able to send a text or make a call with my thoughts?
Very likely. In fact, some people already can do that. And the people who are able to do that right now have more powerful neurotechnology. That's implanted neurotechnology. You know, it's the likes of what Elon Musk is developing at Neuralink or Synchron has. And these are people who've lost the ability to communicate otherwise. And the reason that the implanted technology works better for those purposes right now than wearable is it's deeper in the brain with far more sensitive electrodes that are picking up electrical activity. But thanks to advances in AI and improvements in the hardware, wearable neurotechnology is getting closer to that, where within the next couple of years, I think there will be more and more consumer products that allow you to make a phone call or send a text message by wearing one of those devices, and that becomes the way you do it, rather than picking up the phone and using your fingers or typing it out on a keyboard or on a mobile device.
Okay, between the wearable stuff and AI, I'm getting a little bit creeped out here. but is this going to be just like any advance in technology? I mean, you know, people 50 years ago, if they saw an iPhone, would be thinking that's like something out of the Jetsons.
Yeah, I mean, so it could. It's certainly the hope of most of the AI companies that are investing in neurotechnology is that this becomes the next big thing. But I would just caution that before it becomes the next big thing, the reason I wrote the book, The Battle for Your Brain, is our brains, what we think about, that's really our last bastion of privacy. It's like the one space that you have where you can think whatever you want to think without a fear of being persecuted based on what you think. And before we just adopt that as willingly as we have adopted every other technology, we need to have in place some protections for people that would protect them from having that misused against them or commodified. Like if you look at when you're on a social media site, all of your personal data is collected and then used to advertise to you or to try to keep you on the device as long as possible. We don't want the same fate to be true for our brain data because that would lead us to a pretty risky place for our ability to continue to be autonomous, independent humans.
You know, Doctor, there's that old saying, a penny for your thoughts. Is it going to be a lot more than that? Can they glean what I'm thinking and then sell that to somebody who may want to influence what I buy or what I do?
Potentially. Right now, there are a few states that have adopted laws that try to prevent that from happening. But for the most part, across the U.S., there's really nothing that prevents a company from taking the data it collects on its devices and then selling it to a third party. And selling it to a third party could include, for purposes of advertisement. Notice one of the companies that I mentioned earlier in our conversation that has the first major commercial product, which is Meta. And there isn't a law other than in a few states that really would prevent Meta from taking the data that it collects. It wouldn't need to sell it to advertisers. It would simply go into the bigger behavioral profile that they've already created about each person to be able to create more precise targeting of advertisements and products.
You know, there are people who believe that iPhones are listening to you. And if you even mention the word Hawaii, all of a sudden you're getting ads for vacation trips to Hawaii. I mean, could it happen with our thoughts too? I'm thinking, ooh, pizza sounds good right now. All of a sudden, there's something prompting me to buy a pizza?
You know, that's the kind of scenario that I, you know, kind of envision in my book, The Battle for Your Brain. You're walking down the street, you know, you're already giving away your geolocation data, so it knows exactly where you are. You are hungry, and your neural activity shows that you're hungry, and you're close to a sushi restaurant near you, and all of a sudden, what pops up on your phone but a discount to go into the sushi restaurant? Now, some people are going to think that's great and they're happy to give away their personal information. I personally worry about that deeply because I worry a lot about human autonomy. Like, how do we know the choices we make, the things that we do, what we feel, and what we want is our own rather than manipulated into us? And I think part of how you safeguard against that is by being able to safeguard what you're thinking from being misused in those kinds of contexts.
Just wondering if anybody else is getting what she calls the heebie-jeebies from this.
Yeah. There is incredible promise with neurotechnology, and I think that there are a lot of reasons that people may embrace it in the future, including to be able to have better insights into their brain health and well-being. But we need a different relationship between neurotechnology and consumers than we've had with other digital technologies. We need them to be much more privacy sensitive. They need to not have data that is used and misused in ways that we've seen time and time again with almost every other technology.
Thank you for listening to On Deadline, your radio news from Odyssey. On Deadline is written and produced by me, Christy Strasser, and by Lauren Barry. Subscribe wherever you get podcasts.